Let me just say a word here about Dr. Michael Kaufman. He heads Environmental Perspectives. He's an educational research organization that since 1992 has been helping citizens across America to understand the dangers of the environmental movement and how false environmental catastrophes like global warming are being used to justify the need for world government, first of all. Let's see here. Science says that it's a 90% certainty that global warming is man-made or somehow related to the way society lives today. In other words, we are to blame. Now, that was not the case as recently as 2003, when only 56% said global warming was man-made. Then I'm wondering what made the giant change between as recently as 2003 and currently the summer here of 2008. All right, so we have policy being formed based on what just a few years ago only half of our scientists said was the case. We have jobs being lost. We have fuel shortages. We have food shortages because of guys like Al Gore. And we're going to play a clip where Al Gore acknowledges that one of the purposes and one of the goals of this whole global warming effort is, in fact, global government. Dr. Kaufman, are you there?
I am.
All right, good. I'm so glad. I apologize for the... But it's a pleasure to have you back. You were with me about a year and a half ago, and I have viewed your film, The Global Warming ? Or Global Governance. And maybe you can answer a couple of the points I started out with, and that is that today scientists say there's a 90% certainty that global warming is man-made. As recently as 2003, that percentage was only 56% of scientists. So what made this big difference? Is this a guy by the name of Al Gore?
Yes, in many respects it is. And the basic stacking of the deck, as it were, there are not 90% of the scientists that believe that man is causing global warming. In fact, there's probably much less than half now. What has actually happened in May of this year, last month, there was a release of 32,000 names of scientists. 32,000 scientists had actually signed a petition saying that it was very unlikely that man was responsible for creating global warming.
Mm-hmm.
32,000 scientists. That's a big chunk of the scientific community in this nation. In 2001, that was 17,000, so it has doubled almost in the last 5 or 6 years. In 2003, when the survey was done of just climatologists themselves, we're talking about just those people who are experts in this field, only 56% of them said that the science was not settled, and 46% of them basically said man was not responsible. That has changed now,
mm-hmm.
So I think it's actually reversed, and we have the vast majority of scientists as saying this. The IPCC, United Nations Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, is basically a political organization with ties to the scientific community. The policy for summary makers that came out in 2007, last year, is made up of political statements, not scientific statements. And let me just clarify that just a little bit for you. How this process works within the IPCC is that basic scientists input their raw material into this committee of politicians, basically bureaucrats and politicians. They massage the data and then present the policy summary for policymakers that you hear on your evening news and in your newspapers and so forth. They give it back to the scientists then, and the actual policy statements are usually quite different from what the statements were of the scientists that went into it. Now the scientists have to adjust the final report to conform with the summary for policymakers. So it's not a real scientific report. It's a political statement based on some scientific input. And when it comes right down to it, analysis was done under the Freedom of Information Act this year that showed that only 4 out of the so-called 2,500 that they claim forms a consensus on this issue, only four scientists actually endorsed it. Only four.
Okay.
And there's 32,000 scientists, 9,000 of them of which are PhDs, that come out and say it that it's not happening. This is the type of distortion that is happening in our political arena and in our media. The media just totally ignores anything contrary to the basic doctrine that man is causing global warming, and then goes off on its own and basically picks out scientists that will support the view that man is causing global warming. And that's what you see on the evening news.
All right. And that's true. And Al Gore would say that, I mean, Greenland is melting, and we're going to have the destruction of the polar bears and things like that. And by the way, you relate in the film, and I'll refer more to your film later and how folks can get a hold of it, but you relate in the film how a plane crashed in Greenland. What was the purpose and the outcome of that story?
Well, the plane crash in Greenland on the Greenland ice cap occurred in 1942, and that was brought about because they had no place to land. The airport that they took off in Greenland was now fogged in. The airport that they were going to in Iceland was fogged in and stormy, and so they were forced to land on the Greenland ice cap fairly close to the eastern coast. And what happened was that in 1982, a team went in there to try to find those planes. They figured they'd be a few feet under the ice and so forth. Well, that took them 10 years to actually find those planes. And where they found them, they were 265 feet below the ice surface.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's 265 feet below the ice surface. They were in still very good condition. They were able to get one of the planes out, disassemble it, and reassemble it, and it flies now. I mean, they weren't crushed. There was a couple of them that were crushed, but most of them were still in very good condition. That means that 265 feet of ice had formed over the top
mm-hmm.
of those planes in the 50-year period between 1942 and 1992. What we're seeing now is some melting along the edges of Greenland, not in the center of Greenland. And ironically, in 1200 A.D., there was a little, medieval warm period in which Vikings settled in Greenland. And the Vikings settled in areas that are now covered with ice. It got very cold in the 1700 A.D. We had what's called the Little Ice Age. It was about a degree and a half colder than it is right now. And we've been recovering from that Little Ice Age ever since. And ironically, in Greenland, where these planes were, we had been accumulating ice. Now that ice is melting somewhat, and it's nothing to be alarmed. It's part of a natural cycle.
Yeah. All right, so why the scare tactic? And apparently the scare tactic, because that's where we're ultimately heading, is that there's an agenda driving this, and we can get to that agenda fairly soon here. But apparently these scare tactics are there for a reason. And you would say, based on your film, Global Warming or Global Governance, is that they are using this vehicle of global warming to help push the effort of global government around the world.
That is correct. There is a broad range of efforts going on to what is called global governance by the United Nations and the international community, including many within the administration. It doesn't matter if it's Democratic or Republican administration in the United States. And in order to do that, they have to cede certain parts of our sovereignty to a higher level of government based in the United Nations. And the whole global warming effort is part of that effort to be able to control our economy. And the reason why, if you just think about it for a moment, there isn't a thing that you do during the day that doesn't link somehow back to some energy use. Even if you're watching TV or building a house, for instance, your 2x4s that you build a house had to come from a mill somewhere that had to be transported to your location from that mill and so forth. That all requires energy. That energy always results in the expelling of carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide is supposedly the greenhouse gas that is causing this global warming. It's not. We'll talk about that in a moment.
Yeah.
But the fact is, if they can control the emissions of greenhouse gas, they basically can control the economy of the United States. And that's really what they're trying to do.
All right. And let's look at here a few bullet points about the basic problems that we're dealing with here. And you've outlined them, and I believe they may be on your website. That's perhaps where I got the bullet points. But number one, there's no concise science. There's no clear, concise science on the issue of man-made global warming. And then secondly, you say economic consequences that could be disastrous to this country, any country, could happen, driving industries out of the U.S. Maybe you could elaborate on that, because this is huge. We're in an economic downturn as we speak today. And here we've got all sorts of efforts that are driving businesses out of the country. And some of that is based in greed. But one of the biggest ones is this global warming push.
Yes, it is. And it's really unfortunate, because the $4-plus gasoline that we're facing right now is in large measure due to a number of things dealing directly with this agenda. First, it's the fact that we have not produced, not built any new refineries in this country for the last 30, 40 years. That is due primarily to the environmental regulations that our Congress has passed. And as a consequence, it's made it physically impossible or economically impossible for companies to build those kinds of processing facilities here in the United States, because it's way too expensive. It's better to build them someplace else and ship the gasoline in already produced, which takes jobs away, of course, from Americans. Now, we need some of those environmental regulations. Don't get me wrong. We do need some environmental protections. But at the same time, the regulations that have been imposed on the oil industry are so draconian that they're really far and above what is actually necessary to protect the environment, to protect our health. So what we're doing is we shot ourselves in the foot in one place by not building any new refineries. Secondly, we're not developing any new oil sources within the continental United States. We have ANWR in the Alaskan area that we could have developed 10 years ago that would have been online. If we had that online, chances are we would not be having the high spikes in gasoline prices that we're experiencing right now. We're finding politicians saying, well, we can't do it now. It's going to take 10 years. Well, if we'd have done it 10 years ago, it's the exact same thing they said 10 years ago, we wouldn't have the problem that we have right now. Plus, there is tremendous oil reserves off the continental shelves, or just on the edges of the continental shelves, not within the view shape of our beaches and so forth, that have been forbidden to be developed for the last 30 years. We could develop those and solve the problem that way, too. Yes, it'll take a few years, but at least we could get started someplace. And then finally, we have 250 years worth of oil in the shale oil of the Rocky Mountains. And all those have been prohibited to develop as well. All of those can be done very easily at $50 a gallon oil. We're now at $140 a barrel, $140 a barrel oil. And there's no reasons we cannot develop these in a very environmentally conscious way.
Dr. Kaufman, let me move on here with some of the major problems that we see in the area and the arena of this global warming issue. We have non-developed countries being let off the hook here, correct?
That is correct.
And give me an example of some non-developed.
Well, China, India, Russia, none of those so-called non-developed countries are being held responsible for the accords and the Kyoto Protocol. And as a consequence, it's primarily Europe, Australia, and the United States that would be under the Kyoto Protocol if we were to sign on to the Kyoto Protocol. President Bush has refused to do that, and he's come up with his own alternative plan, which is a lot better, but still you have to ask the question, if man is not causing global warming, then why have all the restrictions on carbon dioxide emissions? That comes down to the basic question. If it's a natural phenomenon, there is nothing we can do about it. If it's man-caused, yes, maybe we should take a look at it, but should we be putting our money into trying to stop carbon dioxide emissions and destroying our economy in the process, or should we look at putting our money into adaptation where we adjust to the increasing temperatures? And by the way, increasing temperatures isn't necessarily all that bad. We can talk about that.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute, but I'm not quite through here with China because, all right, China's let off the hook here. They don't have to follow any kind of guidelines. They don't have to follow Kyoto. And yet you and I know that China is far dirtier, and I'm speaking here from an environmental standpoint, far dirtier than America could ever be.
That's correct. In fact, China, if you look at satellite photos, what you'll see is in the southeastern Asian area, this very kind of a reddish haze over all of that particular area because of the tremendous pollution that China is really putting out. It's just unbelievable. how much actual pollution they're putting out. In fact, as far as carbon dioxide itself is concerned, China exceeded the United States last year in its carbon dioxide emissions.
Okay, so why?
And yet they're not.
Why no pressure on China? Why no outrage against China?
Because they knew they couldn't get China on board, and as a consequence, they gave them a pass to try to get the control over the United States economy of the United States and Europe. In fact, in Europe, it's not working there either. You know, even without any mandated restrictions, the United States has reduced its carbon dioxide emissions greater than Europe, except for Germany and, I believe, France. Those are the only two nations in Europe that have actually done better than the United States. And what they're finding now is that their citizens in Europe are about to throw these governments out on their ear because the cost of energy has skyrocketed so much that if you think we're hurting here in the United States on energy costs, they're paying $10 a gallon.
Yes, you're
right. Typically in Europe.
You're right. Do you anticipate, you were discussing the oil issues just seconds ago. Can you project at all that perhaps America could be experiencing that in the next year or two?
It could. There's been a lot of projections saying it will. One of the other factors is the ability of the futures market to drive these prices up as well. And right now there's legislation pending in Congress that will probably turn off that or control that better. There's mixed emotions. I read reports every day on this, and there's mixed reports. If it continues to do exactly as it's been doing the last year and a half, 2 years, yes, it probably can get up to $6 to $10 a gallon. But if these futures operators get reined in so that they cannot be bidding so high, that probably will not happen.
Okay.
Plus, the actual demand in the world today is such that the prices should be half of what they actually are. So right now, the supply and demand situation, if these future people get reined in, chances are we'll go down to less than $100 a gallon. We'll never see $40 a gallon again, or a barrel, I mean. But we will perhaps see $70, $80, $90 a barrel, which will bring the price down of gasoline into the $2 and $2.50 a gallon basis.
Okay. And do you have any kind of a projected timetable? And I know you're only, if this is a guessing game, but would you have a projected guessing game time for when that might happen?
It's a real hard thing to say, but I would say it'll take at least 6 months to work through the system if Congress passes this bill.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to couple more of the major problems in this whole arena that we're talking about as it concerns these global warming issues. A major issue is that it is a threat to national sovereignty because, again, the ultimate goal here is global governance, and folks, we'll get into that. Danger to national security is one issue, and a danger to national sovereignty is another issue. Clearly, if, in fact, this is heading into a global governance issue, we are threatening national sovereignty. But Dr. Michael Kaufman, how would national security be being threatened by this push for global warming and the Kyoto Protocol and so forth?
Well, it's a very interesting thing because what happens is with national security depends on energy, too. We have the oil reserves here in the United States, the strategic reserves, and that will help a little bit. But what happens is that if everybody has to pay more, so does our military, and it becomes more of the actual funding for our military going into nothing but transportation and that type of thing rather than to making the state-of-the-art weapons and so forth to defend us. It has tremendous national security. That's one level.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger level is the fact that if we're getting 60 to 70% of our oil offshore at this point, as we are, that means that if we get into an emergency, we could have our oil supply shut off, and that would just destroy this country within a matter of a month and a half.
Okay. Well, those were some of the major problems with this whole topic that we're talking about. If something major has been left out here, would you fill in the blank, please? Because we've covered about six bullet points that really trouble me.
Well, one of the things that you said that I did not address was the fact that there is no real science to back up man-caused global warming, and that is correct. It is really astonishing when you dig into the science, and even a layperson can do this without too much trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Just dig into some of the skeptical comments made by on the internet and so forth by many, many hundreds of scientists that are basically skeptical of man-caused global warming, and you will see very fast that the whole scenario of man-caused global warming is based on modeling. It's nothing but modeling. That these models project that in the future, with increasing carbon dioxide, we're going to have increasing temperature. Well, this year, there has been a major breakthrough in the scientific arena that shows very clearly that the models themselves are making the wrong assumptions, almost every single one of them. Let me just kind of give you an idea. If you can imagine the Earth's atmosphere from the north to the south, and the equator at the equator and maybe to my 30 degrees south and 30 degrees north of the equator, there's going to be supposedly, if carbon dioxide is causing this warming, is going to be warming about 2 to 3 times as much at about an elevation of about 6 miles high compared to the surface. Why? That's because where carbon dioxide is found. That's where it's trapping this heat, if it's going to be doing that, re-rating it, forming more water vapor, which in turn causes more warming at the lower elevations. Now, if I haven't confused you too much yet at this point, this is the physical manifestation of CO2 warming. It has to happen. There is no other way that carbon dioxide could be warming the atmosphere. So you're supposed to see this very warm pool up about 6 miles high above the equator, plus or minus 30 degrees. It's not happening. In fact, if anything, there's cooling at that elevation. So physically, all the models that are being used to justify man-caused global warming are making the wrong assumption.
Okay.
It cannot be happening, and the models are totally wrong.
All right. If
the models are totally wrong, then the whole assumption that man is causing global warming is also wrong.
One of the major issues, if there is an element of global warming, and you bring it out in the film, Global Warming or Global Governance, is that there are more sunspots. When there are more sunspots, there is a warmer temperature. Am I correct?
That's correct. In fact, you can go back over 400 years that they've had the telescope and see this very clearly. There's about an 80% correlation that shows that the number of sunspots on the sun is correlated with the temperature of the Earth. Now, that doesn't mean the sunspots themselves cause it. What it means is that the activity on the sun, which causes the sunspots, also changes the type of energy that enters or is thrust towards the Earth. And in the process of doing that, what happens is that there is cosmic radiation coming in from the universe to the United, to the Earth. This cosmic radiation is made up of exploding supernovae and so forth, the energy from those. When the sun is not active, it's not pushing as much energy out, and as a consequence, more of the cosmic radiation comes in. And there is about a 99% correlation with the amount of cosmic radiation and cloudiness of the Earth, the lower level clouds. The more cosmic radiation there is, the more lower clouds they are. Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that there are more low clouds, it's going to be cooler, because much of that energy coming in from the sun is reflected off the top of the clouds back into this out into space. But when the sun is more active, when it's putting out more X-rays and gamma rays and so forth in the solar stream, what happens is, one is that you have aurora borealis. That's when you have major aurora borealis. But it also pushes the cosmic radiation back out of the what's called the solar hemisphere. The effect of the sun out into the outer planets of the solar system. And what is actually happening then is there's less of this cosmic radiation coming in, therefore less lower cloud formation, more of the solar energy reaches the Earth's surface, and as a consequence, we're seeing more warming during those periods of time. So there is very little relationship with carbon dioxide and temperature. There's almost none. You can go back, let's put it this way. Al Gore in his video shows very clearly there's a high correlation between the levels of carbon dioxide and the levels of and the temperature of the Earth. Go back 650,000 years. But the correlation does not mean cause and effect. And in fact, I tell you right now that there's 100% correlation that everybody that's right now breathing air is going to die. It's just that's a correlation. That doesn't mean it's a cause and effect. In fact, if you didn't breathe air, you're going to die a lot sooner. The question is then, is carbon dioxide driving the temperature, or is the temperature driving the carbon dioxide? Well, if you actually superimpose those graphs, what you'll find is that somewhere between 200 and 800 years, that the temperature increases is followed by a carbon dioxide increase, and when the temperature declines, there's a 200 to 500 years later, a decline in carbon dioxide as well, which then suggests that there's a physical relationship with the atmosphere and the ocean, because the ocean holds about 40,000 times more carbon dioxide in it than the atmosphere does. As the ocean warms because of solar heating, what you find is that it can hold less carbon dioxide. It emits that carbon dioxide out in the atmosphere, when in fact there's less when the oceans start to cool because there's more cloudiness. What happens is it can absorb more carbon dioxide, and it absorbs that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere back into the ocean. That is the relationship. It's not the other way around.
All right, let's move on to this issue then of global governance, or global government means the same thing, because basically what I'm learning from studying this from you, particularly and speaking to Dr. Michael Kaufman, is that this is an agenda-driven issue. And you propose that the agenda is global government, also known as global governance, that the environment is being used to form a one-world government and a total one-world system. Now, how is it doing that? How do we connect the dots? Now, I suspect that the United Nations plays a role in all of this. Is the real agenda ceding sovereignty to the UN?
Yes, it is. That is the whole agenda at this particular point in time. It doesn't have to be the UN.
Yeah.
Any international organization, the UN is the one that they created in 1945 for this purpose, and it almost was aborted in the 1970s and early 1980s, but now it's coming back into a prominent role and probably will be the vehicle by which they attempt to do this. If the United Nations has basically all these international treaties, especially environmental treaties, the Convention on Climate Change, the Convention on Biological Diversity, the Convention on Desertification, I can go down, there are dozens of these things. Each one of them by themselves takes some of our sovereignty, because according to the Constitution, we have to adapt our legal system to whatever treaty we sign. Now, I don't think the founders, when they wrote that provision, thought that we'd have to exceed the Constitution in the United States, but that's how it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court. So the treaty now becomes the force of law, even though it contradicts the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, as we cede these various aspects of our sovereignty to the United Nations, what happens is we have gradually a migration from national sovereignty to global sovereignty. And that is what's happening in carbon dioxide, in the issue of global warming. Is control over primarily the economies of the world, who can do what and when, by how much carbon dioxide they're emitting.
All right, I want to try, and pray again, folks, I'm going to try this clip one more time, because it starts out with Phyllis Schlafly giving a warning on this. It moves on to Al Gore talking about the need for global government, and we have a third voice. I'm going to have you tell me who that is, Dr. Kaufman, but let's try it one more time. And, Brian, if it doesn't work, cut it immediately.
All these treaties are dangerous attacks on American freedoms, national security, land ownership, and private property, or our use of natural resources and energy, or our land. And together they add up to what is meant by global governance.
Yes, Senator, it's a global problem, and it has to be solved with a global strategy. But this is the rare but all-important global or strategic problem. Its aspect is in the global dimension, and every nation has to be a part of the solution.
The environment is being used for a power struggle. The environment is being used for centralized government. The environment is being used to make a one-world government. This is an awakening call that we are facing a battle against those that want to destroy a great United States of America.
I know you weren't able to hear much of that, Dr. Kaufman, but the bottom line, I'm not sure who that third voice was, but the bottom line, and Al Gore speaking out himself, saying that this is the purpose of this effort, is the global governance.
Absolutely. He mentions that very clearly in his Senate talk back in last year, and the third voice was Congressman Don Young from Alaska, who was basically saying that there's a direct effort out there by many of the internationalists to take over the sovereignty of the United States.
Okay, now, there are some organizations, and you and I are going to sound a little bit conspiratorial here, and the only time I go in this direction is when it is pointing to the effort to gain a one-world system or a one-world government, and I only go there because the Bible says that's going to happen. Otherwise, I am not a conspiratorial person. But there are some agencies that are pushing for all of this, and let's talk about just a few of them anyway. And one of them would be the Council on Foreign Relations, and another one would be the Trilateral Commission, and another one is your friend and mine, Gary Kaa, has brought out on my program, this Club of Rome. How are these organizations, because let's face it, they are made up of not millions of people, they may be made up of hundreds at the most. How are they able to actually how are they able to think that they're going to be successful in changing the entire way humanity has existed, particularly the United States of America? Just these few little organizations made up of a few hundred people who call themselves elitists.
Well, it's a very interesting question, because it's one in which you have a mindset amongst the elite that almost is universal, is that they can run the world better than you and I can. They can run our lives better than we can. In many cases, their goals are altruistic in the sense that they want to stabilize the economies of the world, they want to prevent war, and so forth. And as a result of that, you know, their goal is altruistic. However, how they get there is very tyrannical, because in order to do that, they have to stifle the rights of you and I. And they come together on these annual basis or many times during the year, depending on which organization you're talking about, to discuss the goals. And then they have a whole cadre of what bureaucrats basically underneath them that begin to start working towards these goals. It's not a lockstep, and it's really one of those things where you have to be careful, because this is not a Hitler type organization where just a few people guide the whole thing. It's a goal in which many people participate in reaching a general goal, and they have different ways of doing that. And as a consequence, what you do is you insert people that are involved in these elite organizations into key government positions or positions of power within the industrial world and so forth, and they organize their agency or their domain, as it were, if it's a company or whatever, towards achieving this long-term goal. It takes many lifetimes, really. It's generations. This has not just been something that's created in the last 30 years. It's been going on for hundreds of years. And gradually, through a number of things, and they have Madison Avenue techniques now to convince you that you need to buy a certain tube of toothpaste or something like that. Well, the same approach works on this issue of, say, global warming. Back in the 1970s, you found that we were heading into global cooling, the next ice age. That was the big fad. But these scientists warned them that we're going to not have this continuing cold period. It's going to go back into global warming period, so they begin to shift in the 1980s the mentality from global cooling to global warming. And every time you turn around, what you're seeing is more information that man is causing global warming, sneaking out through different things. There's a whole cadre of scientists whose lives depend upon their putting forth the idea that man is causing global warming. They would be out in the street the next day if they did not say that, those sorts of things. Many of them actually believe it. Don't get me wrong. A lot of them really believe in their heart that we're having man-caused global warming.
Okay.
But a lot of them are doing it just because that's where their next research grant is going to come from and so forth, that they can feed their family with. And what we're seeing here is what appears to be everything coming in from a dozen different directions because of a common goal to create this world government or global governance, as the United Nations calls itself. And it's a process. It's been ongoing for a long time, and it's not going to quit in very soon. But the one thing that I did try to do in this DVD that you're selling, Jan, mm-hmm. is, one, dispel any doubt that man is causing global warming. It's impossible to believe that man is causing global warming after you see this DVD. Then I go into the whole issue, and I use many different scientists. I use almost two dozen different scientists and experts on the issue of global warming and so forth, that they, in their own words, tell the listening audience or watching audience what is happening in the real science of global warming. Then we go into the discussion of global governance as to why this is being implemented. And it's a dynamic DVD, one in which we get a constant comments back from people that have watched it, saying that, you know, I believe that man was causing global warming before I started this. I realize now I've been taken for a fool, and I'm angry at why they're trying to do it. It's been very effective in that way.
You know, Dr. Kaufman, I want to say right up front that, you know, the Bible tells us to be good stewards. We have dominion over the earth, and that we need to be good stewards of the earth. And I am not saying, and I don't think you are either, that there are those out there who are in no way doing anything conspiratorial, who are simply trying to take good care of the earth. For instance, I care. I'm sorry, but I do. I care about the polar bears, and I care about the whales. And there are a lot of good people who are into some environmental efforts. Not everyone into environmental issues goes to the extreme that you and I are talking about. And I think we need to make that clear.
Absolutely. You know, I am an environmental scientist. This is what I have my PhD in, is in environmental science, because I like the environment. I want to protect it. And one of the things that I think I've found in the general society is that, you know, even within the Sierra Club, many of the people that work for the Sierra Club want to do it for exactly the same reasons you just described for yourself, Jan. They want to do it because they care about the environment. It's the leadership in which is driving the ship in this way, and they're using us and our concerns for the environment as lackeys in order to accomplish what they want to do. It is an unbelievable agenda in which they know they have the natural sensitivities of every person to protect the environment, to protect the polar bears, to protect the trees and so forth, in order to advance their agenda. Their goals are not necessarily bad. It's how they're getting those goals and what they're doing in the process that is so horrible. Because we're paying over $4 a gallon of gasoline. That's a direct result, absolute direct result of their efforts over the last 30 years.